Now, wait till you listen to this story. Two former participants in the CIA's Mars visitation program back in the early 1980s say that President Barack Obama was enrolled in their Mars training class in the 1980, was among the young Americans from the program who they later encountered on the Martian surface after reaching Mars via the jump rope. Andrew Bishago, he's been on the program before, lawyer in the state of Washington who served in DARPA's time travel program Project Pegasus in the 70s when he was a youngster, and William Stillings, a 44-year-old now, who was tapped by the Mars program for his technical expertise, have confirmed, they say, that the president was enrolled in their Mars training class when he was a teenager, and that each later encounter of the president during those visits to U.S. facilities on Mars took place from 81 to 83. Quite a story. Up next, you'll have a series of special guests coming on the program, including the great-great-granddaughter of the late President Dwight Eisenhower and what she had to go through. Andrew Bishago is next on Coast to Coast AM. Are you going to be on a Coast to Coast ride tonight? Andrew Bishago, lawyer from the state of Washington, as I mentioned, rising figure in the truth movement. He holds 5 degrees, including a BA in history from UCLA, Master of Philosophy from Cambridge. Now, back in the 70s, Andy was a child participant in DARPA's time travel program, Project Pegasus. In the 1980s, claims that he visited Mars for the CIA's Mars program. Andy is now the president of Project Pegasus and the Mars Anomaly Research Society. Throughout the night, we'll have some other guests on with Andy, but here he is right now, Andrew Bishago. And welcome back. How are you, Andrew?
Hi, George. I'm excellent.
Good. Tell me a little bit about what you've been doing over the last few months.
My truth campaign proceeds apace. I think it's fair to say that it's entered the mainstream. Recently, I was I had the pleasure of working with Governor Jesse Ventura.
Good guy, by the way.
Yeah, really. He really has a heart of gold. And so we taped a segment of conspiracy theory and some of my old haunts in New Mexico that Project Pegasus took me to as a child 40 years ago. We filmed in Santa Fe right in front of the Bataan Memorial Building, which you may recall was the place they were actually trying to teleport us back when time-space exploration was a new thing in the Defense Department. On the other hand, I've also had the privilege of having my Project Pegasus experiences subjected to a disinformational attack by the History Channel. And I don't think you've really arrived until that's happened. And so they recently did William Shatner did a segment for his show, Weird or What, in which they actually invented an alternate set of experiences that they alleged that I had. And so I don't think they really defame you on the History Channel until you've arrived or until they're convinced that you're telling the truth.
Well, you know what I do, Andy, in this case, and you know you've been on the program before with me, I want our listeners to make up their own mind. I mean, because, you know, they're going to hear your story, and they're going to hear one tonight from you and Bill Stillings. That is truly unbelievable for people to grasp, but I want them to hear it from you. And then they can make up their own mind. And I think that's fair, don't you?
It certainly is. You know, and I think that undergirding this is the fact that really between what the public has been told the U.S. government has achieved and what it has secretly achieved falls everything that lies under the umbrella of official state secrecy.
Give us a capsule of Project Pegasus for brand new people.
Project Pegasus was a classified defense-related research and development program under the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, that was initiated in the late 1960s. Most of its activities were in the early 1970s. And it was essentially the U.S. time-space exploration program at the time of its emergence. It was working with adults and children, but also sort of training the next cadre of chrononauts for the U.S. government, really in two technical areas, in the area of Tesla teleportation and in the area of chronovision, which is the use of electro-optical devices to create holograms of past and future events. So I was one of the 140 American schoolchildren who was brought into Project Pegasus in 1969.
Why kids? Why not adults?
Well, they were using adults for many of the activities in the programming. There were four major reasons why they were using kids. First, they were testing the mental and physical effects of Tesla teleportation on children. If, for example, let's say they had at some point to move the children of our executive branch officials via teleportation, they wanted baseline data on the impact of teleportation on the mental and physical functioning of school-age children. They also needed us because they needed small cooperative human beings, because the holograms that the chronovisors were generating would collapse when larger human beings, namely adults, were used inside the hologram, which kind of created a window to a past or future event. So that was a critical form of intelligence gathering, and so they were giving us specialized training, because when we were in the hologram would not collapse, and then we could use that as a form of intelligence gathering regarding past or future events. We were clearly also trainees in the sense that we were told that some of us would go on to be part of a fully fledged time-space program by the time that we had been put through the Naval Academy and were ready to graduate. They expected that Project Pegasus would have emerged by then into a fully fledged time-space program that would be undertaken secretly to rival the overt space program under NASA.
Did they need you to come back and give them feedback? I mean, could they have sent primates instead of little kids?
Oh, we were very much information gatherers. In fact, we were given specialized training on tachistoscopes, which were speed learning machines that had been developed by the Office of Naval Research. Essentially, we were schooled in everything that had happened in science and society from the time of the High Renaissance, which was, let's say, around the year 1450. And so we were schooled in a curriculum called Galileo, so that when we were, for example, traveling in the past, we would be able to identify things and kind of link up facts, and we were always debriefed after a certain experience in time travel concluded, whether it was teleportation or chronovision or one of the several other technologies that were already had already been developed by 1970.
Andrew, tell us what the CIA's Mars visitation program is.
Well, in 1972, around the time that I left Pegasus, there was another time travel technology that had emerged. In the labs in New Mexico that I was taken to, there were small devices about the size, let's say, of microwave ovens, in which documents from the East Coast were being sent. Now, sometime between 1972 and the late 70s, that technology had been modeled into jump rooms. A jump room is essentially an elevator-like device that you stand in, and while you're standing in this sort of freight elevator-like rectilinear box, it morphs into a cylinder and arrives somewhere else. Now, how this is accomplished, I have no idea. Okay. It was never explained to those of us who were placed in the CIA's Mars visitation program beginning in the summer of 1980. But by the late 1970s, if, for example, were to use Michael Relf's account of taking the jump room to Mars, by 1976, this technology existed. My experiences vis-a-vis Mars began in the summer of 1980 with a group of young people who, time has shown, ended up being a fairly illustrious group of individuals.
Including, including Barack Obama, who went by the name of Barry Sotero, right?
Yes. William Stillings, who was one of my classmates, who's going to be on later, and I are 100% certain that when we asked this particular individual his name and when we were socializing with him, after the group of 10 young people in the program, actually we should say that we were getting our schooling under Major Ed Dames, a Coast regular.
Our Ed Dames?
Same individual. Ed was then, this was before his work in remote viewing, he was then a scientific and technical intelligence officer for the U.S. Army. And Brett Stillings and I and eight other young people attended a Mars training course under Ed Dames that was held at a small college in Northern California called the College of the Siskiyous.
And what do you mean by Mars training course?
Well, Ed was gave us about 3 weeks of factual instruction regarding everything that somebody who was going to be sent to Mars via jump room should know. And so he was going into some of the history of the planet Mars, its geology, its hydrology, its humanoid and animal life forms. There was a major segment, for example, on the predator species on Mars that we should look out for, those that we could outrun and those that we would unfortunately not be able to outrun if we encountered them. So it was merely a factual training seminar held in the second 2 weeks of August and the first week of September at the College of the Siskiyous, which is a small community college at the foot of Mount Shasta in Northern California.
By Ed Dames. You're sure it's Ed Dames?
We're absolutely sure it was Ed. We were socializing. First, Brett and I found ourselves at the campground at Lake Siskiyous. Into the second week, we were all living at the dorms at the College of the Siskiyous. And then about five of us and the parent that was in attendance moved to the Finlandia Motel in Mount Shasta, the city of Mount Shasta. And Ed came by some of our evening parties a number of times, and we're absolutely certain that it was Ed Dames, although Brett and I are fairly certain that back then he was Captain Ed Dames.
You know, he has never told us the story on the program, ever.
Well, you know, this is classified information, and I think this is really, in a sense, George, I think you have a sense of the magnitude of this interview. You know, this is the first time that a sitting United States president has not only been identified as a participant in an intelligence program decades before he took office, but also has been linked to the secret space program. So I can appreciate Ed's lack of candor, because after all, he was an adult when he signed the secrecy and loyalty agreements not to talk about this classified defense-related project. I was not an adult in Project Pegasus, and I had only just turned 18 in 1980, and you know, some of us have chosen to go forward and tell the truth. Others have taken, I think, an equally honorable approach of abiding by what they promised to do.
Now, I could see Matt Dredge's headlines tomorrow. Barack Obama was on the surface of Mars.
Of that, Brett and I are absolutely certain. We're not only certain that when we asked this individual his name and befriended him when we were literally living at the same hotel there in Shasta City, that he said Barry Sotoro, which was the Indonesian name that Barack Obama was using before he selected his birth father's name.
Why did Ed Dames tell you, or what did he tell you about why the government wanted to send civilians to Mars via this jump?
It was really quite strange what was going on. We were brought into it on such an emergency basis that our late fathers were actually financing our trips from Southern California, our initial trip from our homes in Southern California to the Mount Shasta region. They were literally paying for our movement there via, out of pocket.
Room and board, all that stuff.
Just in terms of financing the trip up there.
Just
and
to get you there.
Whether they were going to be reimbursed by the CIA. Ed explained during the three-week seminar that there were a number of sort of internested reasons why we were putting civilians on the surface of Mars. Civilians, I might add, American citizens of different ages and races and backgrounds and so forth. Generally speaking, he stated that the United States government had decided to establish a defense regime on Mars, protecting the Earth from threats from outer space. Now, I don't mean necessarily extraterrestrial beings. I mean all manner of threats to Earth, including, for example, the prospect that Earth might be hit by an asteroid.
Okay.
So they wanted to use Mars, which is on an irregular orbit with Earth, as kind of a staging base for that extraterrestrial defense regime. In furtherance of establishing that, they also wanted to put as many civilians as possible, not soldiers, not diplomats, not astronauts per se, but civilians on the surface of Mars, so that a basis would be created in public international law for the United States government to later assert a claim of territorial sovereignty over Mars.
And they were colonizing Mars.
Yes, 30 years ago. And I should add that also in furtherance of sort of normalizing human relations with Mars, or in expectation, that is, of more human beings from Earth going to Mars and even settling there, they wanted to use us essentially to acclimate the Martian humanoid and animal species to our presence, because they were anticipating placing a U.S. colony there. And as our guest during the last hour, Laura Magdalene Eisenhower, will describe, that base already exists, because indeed she was invited to join that secret colony in 2006 and 2007.
But did not go.
But chose not to go.
Now, explain to us, and we're going to get back into more of the, you know, the training and what the Major Dames was working on, who you say was a captain at the time. What's the jump room, and how does it work?
It's remarkably simple. The jump room that we were using was literally the elevator at a Hughes aircraft facility that was located at 999 North Sepulveda Boulevard in El Segundo, California, immediately south of the Los Angeles International Airport.
Okay. I know where that is.
The elevator, yeah, just right across West Imperial Avenue there from the southern perimeter of LAX. The jump room was literally the elevator room. We would take the elevator up to the fifth floor, check in, give our name first and last, our social security number, our date of birth. We would then go up to the eighth floor, and the room would essentially become illuminated where we could see that something was going on outside the walls of the elevator.
Okay.
And about 10 minutes into the journey to Mars, the rectilinear structure of the elevator would begin morphing into a cylinder, and the ceiling would transit so that we had to kind of adjust our posture as if we were walking through, let's say, a cylindrical water main, as the box-like elevator then morphed into a more of a pipe-like cylinder.
Like a portal.
Yeah, a portal. And the ceiling, which had now translated into the end of the cylinder, had a kind of a swirling pattern. This was during, let's say, the middle 10 minutes of a 20 or 30-minute jump to Mars.
When you got there, were you outside? Did you have to have breathing apparatus on? What was that like?
Well, actually, what was strange is we found ourselves in another elevator-like facility that greeted us, that essentially received the jump room. Now, how this was done, I have no idea. I'm not a physicist. I'm a lawyer. But that's what was happening. The door would then open.
No windows at that time, right?
No windows. There wasn't a later jump room. But the initial one that I was sent to was sort of one story below ground in a kind of a cavern. The modern infrastructure of the jump room had been placed inside this cavern under the surface of Mars. And as instructed, I walked out of the jump room to the right, up a stone staircase, and then through a kind of a dugout, almost like a baseball dugout, behind a statue on the surface. And I then walked through the eye sockets of that head-like structure on the surface, or skull-like statue. And I found myself literally on the surface of Mars. So we were reaching Mars in a transphysical way. That is to say that the material that the jump room was made of was doing things that other substances on Earth have never done.
How long were you on Mars, Andrew?
Well, I went up in two training jumps, and I initially was provided a respiration device. I was greeted there on the surface by three Earthlings.
Military or just folks?
No, these were three civilians working for CIA who were on the surface.
Okay.
I noticed that none of them had a respiration device on like I did, and I was actually shouting through my mask. I'd forgotten that there was a communication device in the mask. Can I take my mask off? And the person who was sort of just standing right in front of me indicated that I could. He was actually laughing his head off that I was shouting. And when I did, I found that I could breathe on the surface of Mars. It was close breathing. It felt kind of like you feel at, let's say, 10,000 feet.
Okay. A little lightheaded?
I beg your pardon?
A little lightheaded?
Yeah, one felt sort of like the early stages of altitude sickness, a little spaced out, a little difficulty breathing, maybe a little anxious because of the brain being signaled that Mars doesn't have the rich oxygen component in its atmosphere that Earth does. So that's something we always had to adjust to. I mean, the swirling at the end of the cylinder, when the jump room morphed into a cylinder, already kind of created a sort of some mental torsion that we had to adjust to. And sometimes it was actually kind of nauseating.
Andrew, we're going to bring in William Stillings to join you in just a moment. He, too, went with you to Mars. We'll be back. And we're talking about the incredible program, apparently, the CIA's Mars Visitation Program. Up next, along with Andrew Bashago, William Stillings joins us. He went, too, when he was a teenager. And we'll be back on Coast to Coast AM. And joining Andrew Bashago this hour, William Brett Stillings, born in Virginia, raised in the intelligence community, the son of a father employed at the Lockheed and NASA's JPL. He was a mechanical prodigy who repaired television sets without instruction at age four. I don't even think that's a field anymore. Nobody repairs TVs. He has served in the United States Navy like I have and worked in the biotech field. In 1980, Brett was enrolled in the Mars training class that included Andrew, what they say is Barack Obama, someone by the name of Regina Duncan. We'll get the reason on her, and sent to Mars from 81 to 83. Here's William Stillings on Coast to Coast. Hello, Brett. How are you?
Doing great, George. Thank you.
Good. And Andrew, you jump in anytime you want. You're on the line here with us, okay?
Certainly.
All right, Brett, tell me a little bit about your involvement in this program, the Mars Visitation Program.
Well, I was enrolled at a very early age through my father, who was a lieutenant. He became a lieutenant, or was a lieutenant in the Office of Naval Intelligence.
Okay.
And was part of the, or went on to JPL, NASA, and Lockheed Skunk Works. And there was a... really only got a about a 1 month warning that I was going to be doing a lot of the things that I was interested in.
Did they like take you? I mean, did you have a choice here?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There was a very much a choice. I was asked, "Do you want to?" And yes, very much so. And it was such a short time that I found myself getting in the camper and going on on a camping trip again and preparing for this.
Now, at what point did you meet Andrew here?
Well, it actually right very much at that time when I got in the camper in the early in 1980, in the summer of 1980, we loaded up the camper, and I got in, and one of the very first things my father said was, you're going to be meeting somebody who's time-traveled, courtesy of the U.S. government, and you're going to be, if you do your studies and do everything right like you're supposed to, you might get to do those things. And we headed off and headed up on a nice 9-10-hour trip and wound up in Shasta.
And did you ever think you two would end up on Mars?
No. That was the farthest thing from my mind.
I mean, at this point, William, do you believe you were on Mars? I mean, are you convinced of that, or how do you know you weren't hypnotized and they just programmed you?
Oh, I've been over this for the last in a life regression kind of way for the last 7 months, and I mean, from everything that I put behind me and what I grew up on, that it was a big success in my life as a kid, and that I got to do those things that a lot of people at the time, you know, that I guessed didn't get to do, was without a doubt when I teleported. You know, is what one of the concrete affirmations was, you know, where did the city go? Where did the buildings go, and freeway and everything, you know, the building that I was in.
What did the planet look like? What did Mars look like?
It had a really light blue sky. It was it was deserty, and there was one of the things of being an amateur geologist was that there was a lot of clay around, and it had a very had a reddish, very reddish ground. Distant was slightly lighter. Just very deserty. It had a chemical feel to it.
Did you see any critters, animals, anything like that running around?
I didn't. I saw on this particular one. I saw bushes, very small bushes, very small, weeds and stuff.
Did you see any water, running water?
I did not.
You did not?
Not on this trip.
And tell me, Brett, about Ed Dames' involvement with this. This fascinates me because, you know, he's been a guest on this program for years, and he has never brought this up, ever.
So, no. he was our instructor at College of the Siskiyous.
Was he a good teacher?
He actually very much was. Very, very attentive. He handled everybody very individually and very systematically.
Okay, and you two are sure it was Ed Dames?
Yes. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Without a doubt. We were...
Do you keep in touch with him now?
No.
You don't. Andy?
Yeah, Ed is one of my Facebook friends, and I've sent him a number of letters urging him to come forward and embrace the purposes of the truth movement and reveal his involvement, really not just in the CIA's Mars program of the early 80s, but he was also an individual that I worked with on a very limited basis in the Montauk chair apparatus when I was a child participant in DARPA's Project Pegasus in the early 70s. So Ed and I actually have a lot in common. I mean, we were involved in the early days of time-space exploration by the U.S. government, but then when the U.S. government selected a direction for that time travel to go, and the destination was Mars, Ed entered that program as well as one of the instructors for the CIA Army people that were training individuals like Brett and I to take the jump room to Mars and survive on a surface where there were, you know, a variety of different predator species, some of which we could outrun and some of which we would not be able to outrun. So he was a brilliant instructor. I mean, he would give us three or four sentences of factual information, very hard-boiled information about Mars, and then maybe put in a joke to kind of relax us about the startling information that he just shared with us. He was coming by our evening parties, first at the dorms there at College of the Siskiyous, and then when we moved over to the Finlandia Motel. So we're certain it was Major Ed Dames.
All right. This episode, going to Mars, why did it stop? Has it stopped?
I don't think it has, George. I mean, one of the really startling things that Major Dame shared with us during our training was that he made a statement that Brett and I have corroborated down to the word, I mean, verbatim. And that was, he stated, and this is summer 1980, he stated that of the 97,000 people we have thus far sent to Mars.
97,000?
That was the fact statement regarding how many had already been sent. He said, of those 97,000, only 7,000 have survived on the surface after 5 years. I think he was addressing both the settlers that they were putting in place, but also those who were being sent, and hopefully with the intent of quickly returning to Earth, as Brett and I were.
How'd the other 90,000 die?
Presumably from predators, and also maybe from privation, in the sense that they were living in rudimentary structures on the surface. There's very little water on Mars. All of the food would have to be gained either through hunting or by having provisions supplied via jump room, which means you'd have to get, let's say, from your little cottage back to one of the jump room facilities to pick up provisions. So I presume that those 90,000 were either eaten or basically starved to death on the surface. But we looked at each other. I mean, this is how strange the material was in the class. I mean, Brett was 13 when we were being trained. I was 18. He was 14 when he first went up. I was 19 when I first went up. And we were looking over at each other in class going, did he just say that? That of the 97,000 that were sent, only 7,000 have survived? But George, this was 31 years ago. We have, during those 31 years, we have the statement provided, the estimate provided by the brilliant researcher David Wilcock, that the U.S. colony on Mars may now number 500,000. I mean, we have the picture that of one of the large bases that Bob Dean revealed publicly for the first time at the European Exopolitics Summit in Barcelona, Spain, in 2009. We have the great-granddaughter of a president revealing that she was invited to join the secret U.S. colony on Mars. So I believe in those 31 years, or now, you know, 28 to 31 years since Brett and I were going up there regularly between 1981 and 83, that there are bases on Mars that may house literally hundreds of thousands of Americans. My,
where would these bases be on the planet?
Well, they would be in the middle ranges of the northern and southern hemispheres because of the more temperate conditions at those latitudes. I don't know specifically where they are, and for that matter, we never learned where the jump room facilities were that we were being sent to.
Okay, and Brett, when you were there, you also encountered Barack Obama.
Yeah, that was when I teleported, I went outside, and there was somebody on my right, which, right near the wall, which turned out to be Andy, or at least was Andy when I turned around after I got to the edge, but there was a ravine over to the right about 150 feet, and I went immediately over there to look around, and I was standing right on the left of Barack Obama.
Was he a nice guy? Did he befriend you at all?
He didn't say anything at all. He was looking around. He was basically self-absorbed of what he was looking at or what he was learning, and just kind of gave a little bit of a nod and walked back in. That whole event lasted about 30 to 40 seconds.
And in Alfred Weber's article on both of you, he writes that Barack Obama, whose name at that time was Barry Satoru, he was identified along with Andy as future presidents.
Yes. Yeah, maybe I could pick up that anecdote, Brett.
All right.
What happened was Barry Satoru was sitting in front of Brett. This occurred in the class in Major Dame's classroom. Barry was sitting in front of Brett. Behind Brett was seated his father, Thomas Stillings, of Lockheed during those years. I was sitting next to Brett, and behind me was my father, Raymond F. Bishaga, who was an electrical engineer for the Ralph M. Parsons Company.
All right, and this is that little college near Mount Shasta.
Right.
Okay.
And, you know, my dad was essentially the chief technical liaison between Parsons and the CIA on teleportation, so he was auditing the class in the same way that Brett's father was and that Barry Satoru's mother, Stanley Ann Dunham, was, in the sense that their children were enrolled, but they also had long-standing ties to the CIA as a result of their work. And Barry Satoru stood up to talk to Ed Dames, and Tom Stillings leaned into the aisle between our two sets of chairs and said, "Brett, how do you feel? How does it feel being in a Mars training class like this with a future president of the United States?" Referring to Barry. And before Brett could answer, my father thrust two fingers into the aisle and, looking at me, stated, "Two future presidents."
Do you have any political aspirations?
George, actually, I've decided to run for president in 2016. I'm going to give my Mars.
Are you really?
Yes, I'm going to be announcing.
Now, if you win, you should, based on this futuristic glimpse into Mars, right?
Well, my father wasn't the only individual with ties to the CIA to talk about a Bishaga administration. Courtney M. Hunt, who was the career CIA officer who gave me additional training for Mars. I mean, he showed me how to use the respiration device. He gave me a suicide pill in the event that I was cornered by one of the predators. He took me to Lockheed, and I took part in a visual simulation of looking out for predators on the surface. Over multiple conversations, 20 years after we were going to Mars, Courtney Hunt of the CIA revealed that I, at some point in my life, reached the White House. Now, that might not be when I first run in 2016, but it was something that was corroborated by both my late father and by literally the CIA agent who trained me for Mars.
Well, you'd be about 54, 55 in 2016, right?
Right, and so I've decided to run in 2016, but I was never given which election I win. It was just the conviction of my father and Mr. Hunt that it was something they were aware of. Now, Brett's father, Thomas Stillings, was astonished by that because he entered that classroom knowing that the African-American individual, Barry Satoru from Hawaii, who had just done a year at Occidental College, was a future United States president. So that really goes to the high strangeness of what we experienced. And it also begs the question, why did the CIA decide to put at least one, possibly two, future American presidents on Mars?
At risk.
Correct. I mean, there's many explanations. One is that they were attempting to prepare us for the awesome responsibilities of being president of the United States and leader of the free world by subjecting us to the experience of going to another planet when we were still in our late teens, early 20s. Another possibility that I've considered is that because they were able to identify future events, including our identities as president, they knew we would reach that point in time alive, so they were simply trying to use information that they had about people from the future and involve them in this program, and that would optimize or maximize the number of people who would survive the experience.
When did you realize that Barack Obama was that Barack Obama that you saw on this Mars program?
Well, this gets very complicated because you may recall that when I first appeared on your show, I mentioned meeting Barack Obama in West Los Angeles in 1982.
I remember that.
When he had transferred to Columbia and I was still completing my education at UCLA. I used that anecdote to describe the fact that he and his friend knew that he was going to be president. Not that he aspired to be president, like you aspire to pitch for the New York Yankees, but they knew to a dispositive certainty that he was destined to be president. But at that time, a heroic individual named William Brett Stillings had not entered my life. Brett contacted me for the first time 6 months after I first appeared on Coast, and we didn't really compare notes about our Mars experiences until June of this year. So actually, when I was on Coast, narrating that first that meeting with Obama that I could remember occurred in West Los Angeles, I was still blocked about my Mars training and visitation experiences. But now we know that one of the individuals in that class was, in fact, Barry Satora, who we now know as the 44th President of the United States, Barack Obama. But I should add, George, that there were two other individuals of note that are among the 5 of the 10 young people that we can identify. The sole female in class was a brilliant young freshman at Caltech. Actually, she was enrolled in a PhD program in mechanical engineering at that time after entering Caltech at age 16, and that was Regina Elvira Dugan.
Okay, that's where she comes in, right?
Right, who President Obama named the 19th director and the first female director of DARPA 6 months after he was elected. So Regina became the director of DARPA, the very agency that gave the United States its time travel capability, on July 20th of 2009. Just recently, Brett and I have identified a 5th individual among that class of 10 teenagers. When we began our training, for the first week, the class was attended by a future United States astronaut, and that was somebody literally 5 days younger than me. And we're happy tonight in a Coast exclusive to reveal that person's identity.
Who is that?
The young future astronaut who was sitting to the far left in the back, in other words, to my left in the back of the classroom, was William Cameron McCool, who was later joined the conventional space program and sadly perished as the pilot of the Columbia.
Columbia, yeah.
And so William McCool was right in that core cohort with Barry Obama and I, born in August and September of 61. That was sort of the median age of the 10 teenagers. Brett was really the outlier in the sense that he was 5 years. I mean, Brett was in junior high school when he was placed on the surface of Mars by the United States government. And if it was not for Brett, we would not be talking about these astonishing facts tonight.
It's unbelievable. All right, Brett, I wanted to thank you for popping on here to talk with us about your trip and this incredible story, Andrew. This truly is incredible. And as we approach the top of the hour, we're going to bring in Laura Eisenhower. She was related to the late President Dwight David Eisenhower. She's the great-granddaughter, and we'll let her tell you her story when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. So get ready for more. Here we go.